Hello and welcome to Before Our Friends Die. You're joined by me, Kavan.
Me, Rash.
And this is the Aki and Saltfish Digital Network. Today we have a very special guest, a friend dear to my heart, Dr. Marcella Day, a renowned researcher in the space of travel and tourism, an academic phenomenon, a phenomenal woman in her own right, and today we're here to talk to her about her study on the barriers to ethnic minority participation in UK domestic tourism. So, before we get started on that, Rachelle, quick question for you. When's the last time you went away in the UK?
Does London count?
Yeah, I think so. Marcella's nodded, so yeah, we'll say that.
Does that count? Because I've got a lot of family there. So I do go to London quite a bit, to be honest. But I don't really go stay a lot anywhere. I normally go around the UK to go eat.
Okay. So where's the last place you went? London. Specifically for food?
London. Maybe Leicester.
Okay.
Leicester.
But is that tourism? Is that tourism or is that...
Well, I guess if you want me to drop in here about what's a strict definition of tourism, it's, in a sense, it is to an extent. It's your purpose of leaving your home. So if you're leaving your home for the purpose of recreation or leisure related activities, then it becomes a form of tourism. However, to be a tourist, there's a time factor that's implicated. Okay. So it means over 24 hours. If it's a one-day trip, which is quite popular, you're then an excursionist.
Okay.
But it's not necessarily recorded as you being a tourist per se. When you have to stay overnight, over 24 hours, that's when we see the difference, because immediately there are implications. If you're staying over, if not staying with visiting friends and family, you're going to need accommodation, you're going to need food, you're going to need stuff like that, or you need perhaps going to want to see things. So why we put the emphasis on the over 24 hours is because immediately there's an economic benefit by you leaving your home and going somewhere else for longer than 24 hours.
Because you're gonna go, you might need to go stay somewhere, eat somewhere. Yeah, it makes sense.
Eat somewhere, look at some stuff. And if it's even also for an event, I mean, you're going, I don't know which teams you support, and I won't get into that saying which teams you support. But if you are going for an away, let's say, match, and you're based here in Northamptonshire, Leicester, and you're going for an away match to say, look at Manchester City or Man U, and you are on that journey and you go for the purposes of watching the match, you, in a sense, you're a form of, you're what you call a sport tourist, because you fall within the category of someone who is going as a spectator. If you stay overnight, even more so. Okay. But even if you go on a day trip, you still is a form of travel and tourism, because you're then an excursionist or a day tripper. And all of these have monetary implications.
So I think it's fair to say, Rasha, you've been on a few local or domestic tourism trips.
You went there today as well, didn't you?
Yeah, my last one was in a place called Moreton, which is in Dorset. And
that surprises you a little bit.
3.5 hour drive. You're deep in the countryside. I stayed in a manor house with my family. It was amazing. You know, we went on daily walks and we went across bridges, across fords, and all these forest walks, and, you know, near the New Forest and all those sorts of places as well. It was good. But I think one thing we'll get onto later is that we specifically went as a large group. That was something, you know, we intentionally did. Durdledore was something we frequented quite often as well. That was nice, lovely. And it was really cold. So I refer to myself as probably a warm weather seeker, which we'll get to later on in the episode. But to be honest with you, I quite enjoyed visiting those places in the winter because no one else was there. It was just us and we could be in and amongst nature, which I value a lot more recently, I would say. But I also made sure I got up early every morning and me and my siblings got a workout in, because as much as we're on holiday, there's still work to do. So that was the mission as well. So before we get into this piece of work, Marcella, that you've done, and you know, it's a massive piece of work, and you unearth some really interesting findings in this research. I want to get stuck into who you are a little bit. So if we were to ask you who is Marcella Day? And we'll give you a minute or two to go over your journey to how you come to be here today. Kick off.
Whoa. Okay, what can I say? Well, I begin by saying that I started this journey as someone who I think had always had an interest in communications, primarily, to be honest. That's where I started out. I liked the idea of sharing and communicating. And I began, surprising enough, in a thing similar to what you guys are doing. I began on radio. My first formal job was in radio. Yes, I used to produce radio programs those days. It's not like how digitalized it is now. Yeah. Used to have to plug and splice and put together tapes in a studio so you could have recording. But it was during that process when I was back home where I'm originally from in Jamaica, I had to cover area of tourism, and I got offer from the head of the tourist board, the Jamaica Tourist Board at the time, to come and work for them, where then I went into public relations and marketing and so on. So did that for about 10 years. Kind of see my age kind of popping up. I know you're calculating, no? I did that for about 10 years. And then I said to myself, I've been doing more or less year in, year out, the same sort of thing. And at the time, I began to challenge and question some of the normal things we were doing. How was Jamaica represented? What was telling people about the experience of a Caribbean island? And being post-colonial, meaning that I was born after Jamaica gained independence, I felt that I had so much of what we were saying about ourselves was what we really kind was a hangover from the days of colonization, and a hangover from how people from the outside wanted to see us. And I didn't think we as a people, as an independent nation, was more or less saying enough of what we felt we were like, we want to be seeing as an island. So that kind of led me into the path of studying and doing a master's and then doing a PhD. And my thesis topic was really about how is it that we imagine the Caribbean? And how is the Caribbean imagined in the media? So you can see there's been really a merging of my interest in the media, communication was my background, and then also the industry. And that's now led me to where I am now, because then I became a researcher, lecturer, and more or less hoping. But, you know, I would just say this to end. I kind of see myself making also another, it's like a 360 degree circle. So I started out media, got into being a practitioner in tourism, marketing, and advertising, and then getting into education. But I find myself now these days, I'm looking again at the practice and trying to make so much of my work more relevant to tourism marketers and people in the business. So I'm finding I'm kind of doing a kind of 360 degree circle. That's more than a minute. Sorry, went over time, but that's it.
No worries. If I could pick up on what you mentioned there in terms of you mentioned there was a conflict in your mind between how Jamaica saw itself and or how Jamaica was presented externally versus how Jamaica saw itself. Could you elucidate that a little bit more? What were the differences?
Well, this is part of the tension at the time, because you think of Jamaica, yeah? And everybody, when they travel the world all over the globe, even now today, even with young millennials and Generation Z like yourselves, if you say Bob Marley, they immediately know what you're saying. The time when I was in tourism and promoting tourism, we never used reggae music.
Right.
In fact, if you looked at our advertising, they were mainly white people. You never if you saw a Jamaican in the advertising, the Jamaican was obviously somebody in a service capacity. Either you were a busboy or waiter, or you were a market vendor with these wonderful fruits around you.
Wow.
You know, you never saw the Jamaican who is independent, aspiring professional. So I think we were kind of caught up in these kinds of tropes of the colonization of us as paradise, but paradise from the perspective of a culture and a place that you consume, not something that you go for an encounter in terms of the richness of the culture. But to be honest, even some people in the marketplace were aware of reggae. They were fascinated by reggae. But we didn't have that confidence in our early, well, I wouldn't say early because I'm looking at in the 90s, up to the 90s. We didn't really have that confidence to say, let's represent Jamaican culture for what it is. There were some people who were feeling it wasn't upmarket enough. It was something that wouldn't resonate with the target markets. You know what I'm saying?
Who was the target market?
The target market is really the major market for Jamaica is the coast's largest country, tourism generating country, which is the United States of America. So it's United States of America. Of course, we also target UK and Europe, but the largest numbers of tourists that do go to the Caribbean generally is from the United States, because you have to think about it in terms of time. If you're going to come from New York and the northern state where it's cold, it's 3 hours to the Caribbean. So that's relatively close. So that's where you go for your most of your visitors. Of course, we do have also a very strong market because of our past links with the UK and also Europe. In the Caribbean, I think it's only Barbados that predominantly relies on the UK market. But for all the other Caribbean countries, that's where they go fishing, in the USA.
It's interesting that you mentioned about you didn't lean on, or Jamaica didn't lean on reggae music, because I wish I knew we was going to go into this topic, actually, because there's a paper that I read a little while ago regarding the Jamaican government's lack of investment and lack of interest in reggae music and lack of support as well. Things like, you know, Apple Music, Spotify, those sort of providers, they don't really work in Jamaica.
What do you mean they don't work?
The infrastructure's not there. Deezer works. And Deezer's given the licenses.
But don't you just need the internet?
Yeah, but you need licenses as well to for the music to go over there, right? And the government hasn't supported those that infrastructure. You know, you've got artists who can't put on shows in Jamaica. You know, the sort of the things we take for granted, the O2, Wembley, O2 Academies, we take all those for granted in the UK. In Jamaica, the artists aren't supported to put on that type of shows. So actually, their audiences are often international rather than local. Sense, it's interesting.
Yeah, it's a bit of a journey. And I think, to be fair to Jamaica, is we have to see it within the context of global players. Because to get on a global market, you more or less will have to interact with the big record companies and so on. Yes, there are certain initiatives that I think in the Caribbean that should be a recognition of the value of our culture. And I think we have been doing that. I think the government has made some lobbying to get reggae recognized as an intangible cultural heritage, and so it's protected. So there are some things that are happening at the governmental level. But yes, there's always this sort of questions as to why the people who are earning the most money from reggae music are not Jamaicans. Not Jamaicans. And we constantly ask that question, and there are no simple answers. And you have to understand that comparatively with more developed countries, post-colonial societies such as ours have had certain challenges that it makes it difficult for us sometimes to really have that sort of command of our culture and be able to say, we're going to put it here, we're not going to put it there, we're going to have a negotiating power, more negotiating power with the big record companies, but it's not as simple as that. But if I would just kind of spin that over and look at it also in terms of tourism, which for me is a major concern, is that in the Caribbean, we don't have a kind of cross-regional airline that can take us between each other and outside. So remember, we are islands. We're islands. You have to more or less, if you're not coming on a ship, you have to come on a plane. And most of us are going by plane. Yeah. And we can't say we have a Caribbean owned airline sector that works. We have some small ones in the Eastern Caribbean. We've had you know, in the past in Jamaica, which is doesn't work anymore, we'd have Caribbean Airlines that now doesn't measure. But it cannot, if those were, it doesn't provide the level of service that we need. So we're always going to be somehow caught in that colonial trap of being dependent on the center. We'll always remain peripheral. And I think this has been a failure. This is where I would come in terms of my own, is a failure of our Caribbean governments to not realize that this industry that we depend so much on, we still have to go and negotiate with the big airline companies. Mm. If when British Airways says, okay, no, this, we're not going to come unless you give us half of your tourism budget and wow, subsidize the flights to come to there, we can't do anything about it.
And is that what happens?
Well, perhaps I think maybe I've exaggerated a bit, but what I'm not, what is the reality is that so many of the routes to the region is subsidized by the islands themselves.
Right.
Because we have to invest in order to keep those gateways open.
That's crazy, that is.
So I'm reading a book at the moment, and it's taking me a long while to get through, I must admit, right? Walter Rodney, How Europe Underdeveloped Africa. And just, I'm mindful we're getting off topic, but briefly, it is that an intentional underdevelopment by the airlines, by the West generally?
I wouldn't say it's in, perhaps I would be perhaps a bit unfair to say it's intentional, but I think we can say it, some intentionality is implicated in the fact that there can be better terms of relationship, and there's a measure, I believe, of exploitation.
Mm.
Because that is the word, dependency. Mm. The dependency that we have on these major markets, and the fact that we haven't been enlightened enough or real enough in terms of our understandings of the global market as a region, that we could come together in a meaningful way. All our regional sort of mechanisms and apparatus, CARICOM and so on, are not really functional in the sense of giving us that sense of independence to wrest us out of the control of this dependency that we still have on the major markets in the United States and Europe. If we could have come together, come up with a proper airline structure and service that carries us not only to North America and back, but carries tourists back, but so that we can hop across to our different island sister states. Mm.
Mm-hmm.
We don't do it. Most of the links between the region, we have to go through Miami or go through New York, mm-hmm, or go through, mm-hmm, some gateway in America to get to another Caribbean island. I mean, we're looking at how many years since the 60s, most of us, or some of us, got independence. We should have been further away in terms of wresting ourselves out of dependency as post-colonial societies than now.
American imperialism doesn't rest. Just to throw that one in there. So the aim of Before Our Friends Die is to have the curious conversations we want to have before we leave this planet. Sometimes that's talking to people who are doing things we want to do, and we're learning how they're doing it. Other times it's creating a call to action for people to do something. So if you're a listener right now and you're tuned into Before Our Friends Die and the Akin Saltfish Digital Network, and this is piquing your interest, what can you do, if you're an entrepreneur, what can you do to liberate and empower the Caribbean to move away from the colonial need and dependency on going through the West to get there? And is there an opportunity, a business opportunity there, to create a local but global airline for the Caribbean?
It's hard to open up an airline.
You know? It's an expensive endeavor.
Very expensive.
Yeah. But maybe one of our listeners knows a few people. Like, you know, we know a few people that know billionaires.
Exactly. Yeah.
On this show. So I'm sure we can make it happen. Not we, but I'm sure someone out there can make it happen off the back of this. So thanks, Marcella, for that. So I want to get now into the research that you did regarding barriers to ethnic minority participation in UK domestic tourism. And that is a very interesting picture that you paint there in the executive summary. You know, some of the stats there are 0.1% of people in the ethnic community in the UK participate in domestic tourism.
That is so yeah. low, man.
That is shocking.
Yeah.
That is very shocking. Yeah. Go ahead, sorry.
No. We're not really traveling within the UK, are we? We're not seeing the UK as a place to go for a holiday. And that's a disappointment. And the stats show for it.
Mm.
But one thing I would say that my research did throw up was that people have a desire to do it. I have described this as a sort of pent-up demand, if I dare to use that term. Mm. And because when I went, you know, when I went through the different transcripts of the many different interviews that I did, it wasn't just with the Afro-Caribbean community. I was getting the same sort of responses coming from the Asian community, from the Chinese community, even from people who are sometimes described as other.
Mm.
In the population census, which are people of Arabic background, they are saying the same thing. So there's something about how we have imagined, how we sell, how we market, how we construct. There are some social relationships implicated in it that makes people think that domestic tourism is activity or kind of leisure activity, which is only for the white population. And that was a little bit disturbing, but I think it definitely comes out in the stats and it comes out in the interviews.
Now, talking of the stats and the interviews, mm-hmm. you mentioned as well that this area generally is quite under-researched. Now, that yeah. piqued my interest because, you know, what are some of your thoughts on that? Why is it under-researched? Is it a matter of there's no money in this? So, you know, yeah. First of all, who funds this sort of research and why haven't they invested in studying ethnic minorities doing UK domestic tourism?
Yeah, and that's, I think, what my report really uncovers and exposes. The fact that the latest data that I could get on that was 2018 from Visit Britain. And there hasn't been any further collection of that kind of data since 2018.
Mm.
So already you see it's not a priority. Yeah. Whereas for other groups, let's say if we're LGBTQI and also with disabilities, people with purposes with disabilities, people with other protected characteristics, there is a recognition on the part of the national authorities, Visit Britain, of them being a distinct segment.
Right.
But there is a silence, there's an invisibility when it comes to. Do we need to then specifically target different ethnic groups that they're not homogeneous? And because of certain characteristics, certain barriers, we definitely have to say the message. We can't leave it to chance and say, oh, we are all in the jolly good United Kingdom.
Yeah.
Yeah. We have to make special focus, investment and resourcing to target these groups. To get them to be part of that experience because the barriers are there.
I'm just surprised they don't already because we're such a big population in this country right now. A lot of people, they're just missing out on a lot of people that they could target.
I think there is still a kind of thinking that you don't really need to look at ethnic diversity when it comes to tourism within on a domestic level because there are stereotypes of thinking. They're saying, okay, if you're going to go back to your country of origin or your parents' country of origin, if you're going to go on holiday, Indians are going to go to India, you're going to go to the subcontinent, Afro-Caribbeans going to go to Caribbean, and Africans are going to go back to different countries in Africa. And just as an assumption, that's how we travel. And that we don't have any other interests. But the irony of it is that you find an increase in numbers of people who are going to Spain,
yep.
France, Italy, of the ethnic minority group, going to Disneyland as well. And people are planning for, you know, for these trips. Now, that means that people, some of the stereotypes, we don't have enough money.
Yep.
Or we're not so well, and you know, we're not so well traveled. Traveling is not part of our kind of social cultural reference point to travel. We just go back home to be with family and friends. We don't really want to see other interests and travel to see places. It's a terrible stereotype that has hindered the thinking and also sort of explaining why the numbers are low. But the numbers are low as well because you don't market to the groups. You don't involve them in your decision making. You don't take on board concerns about what they want to eat. What are the kinds of cultural reference points? About somebody is Muslim, they want to know that they have places where they can go to pray. Yeah.
Yep.
Certain types of food that halal, they want, yeah, as well.
Yeah, halal, yeah.
So you do a check around and you will find how challenging it is to get halal food at a typical hotel.
Mm. Have you ever considered that, Rochelle, in your experiences?
Yeah, if I travel anywhere in the UK, me and my family, friends, we always check if there's any halal spots nearby. So I think we were planning, where's that? Is it Lake District?
Yeah.
There's not a lot of halal places around there, to be honest. It's like probably within an hour drive.
Wow.
There. Yeah, so we were planning to go, to be honest. But normally what we would do is, like you did, get a house there with your friends, barbecue, or make the food ourselves at home. Yeah, so we always take that into account because halal meat is hard to get when you go more up north and south, to be honest.
So is that a decision maker for you?
Me? Yeah, 100%. 100%.
Because that's the point I made in the report.
Yeah.
This I brought to the fore and say, no provision is made. And then what is the problem is that the stereotype that's imposed. They say, oh, well, Asian people really want to go to India. They don't really want to do Lake District. You know, as one of the examples that I used in the report was also of some Muslim workers. I don't know if you've seen, I followed them also on Twitter. And they were saying they did a walk out at the Lake District on Christmas Day. And they saw people were looking at them curiously. And, you know, they were saying, what's the problem? You know, we're out walking. And then we saw some reports that came in. Not reports, some responses to that tweet of them walking. And then somebody said, I was just waiting to see an ISIS flag unfurled.
Mm-mm. So people don't think they can be there.
And there was, you know, when the person who is based in Coventry, that person who leads that group, Muslim Walkers, and he was saying that the amount of abuse that he experienced just taking people up walking on the, you know, in the countryside, it was like he couldn't understand what was that level of hostility. So it's not just not being recognized, being seen as invisible. There's also the actual physical threat, the threatening words, the lack of welcome. I've just ordered a book, which I haven't read yet, but it was interesting. It's called Green Unpleasant Land, and it's written by this lady, which is really an expose of some of the institutionalized barriers to people of color just experiencing the countryside. So you'll be amazed. It is there.
Let's get into some of those barriers then, because you mentioned in your research about one of them was like a risk of racism and the immediate deterrent that can cause for going there in the first place. But then you also talk about where there are negative racialized encounters that restricts revisits. You know, you're not going back. You try it once. It wasn't a good experience. You're not going to go back. What were some of the things that were coming out of your focus groups with regards to that?
Yeah, apart from the kind of typical ones as to why people are not going out much, they say, okay, the weather is too uncertain for us. It's a lot of investment. And then when you go there, you know, and some people say, as we said, we call them warm weather wishers. Mm. I am not going anywhere in the UK in winter.
Yeah.
It's not going to happen. So you have some people who are resolute. It makes no sense to market to them because they're not all year round. Mm. So this particular project I did was really based on Norfolk. I was trying to see how far they could get people off peak coming to the area. So the notion of people of color being a target market during off peak, that's the winter.
Mm.
So immediately you're going to find yourself having a problem if you're targeting people of color in the winter, because there's a hardcore of peer persons in our community who are saying, no way, I'm going anywhere in the winter.
I feel it.
So that's kind of a major barrier. Of course, there are other barriers that we're aware of. As I mentioned before, the lack of provision of food, the kind of accommodation, the fact of not traveling in nuclear families, but as you said, larger groups, yeah. and how many facilities we have that will accompany people who travel with family and kinship groups. That's another kind of barrier of how the industry is set up. But what I found out to be the main way to be able to distinguish people as well in terms of the different segment, in terms of what I call their psychographics, their thinking about travel, is essentially the risk of racism is a deciding factor in people making a travel decision. And for marketers, that is a fundamental issue that you have to address if you are going to be able to open up a target market and start appealing to people coming in. So this is the problem I saw coming out of that report, that people may not accept it, but it's a reality. It's not about the money, because you have people, professional doctors, lawyers, Indian chiefs, all sorts of people who have the resources, yeah. who are using their money to travel all over the world, but they won't go to the Lake District.
Would you say that's top three? Would you say top three barrier, or would that be the first?
I would say the major barrier is racism,
yeah.
but racism in different forms. Racism from the point of view is not so much of, let's say, a physical attack. A lot of people say they're going to feel a physical attack, yeah. but racism from their invisibility, the lack of provision, the kind of unresponsiveness to their needs. It means you are not targeting them, because you're seeing them as a, well, yes, they may be referred to as a subgroup, but it's not only a subgroup, but it's a group that is a, what would I say, a subclass then. We don't need to spend resources to cater to their needs, because there is this thinking that, why should we invest in that? Because do they have the money? Or do they understand the countryside? There are some people who said they don't really understand British culture. Well, as far as I'm concerned, if people were born here, even if they have another ethnic race, they're British.
Mm-hmm.
And they are part of the landscape of what represents British culture.
Yep.
British culture by reason of its own growth, development, by reason of colonization itself, is not entirely white either.
Does the marketing suggest that it is entirely white?
If you look at the typical, you go at it on the typical pages now, we're seeing some inflections of people of color, some little specks of brown and black that's cropping up in some of the photos that you may see on a website for regular UK destination or seaside destinations. But if you go through most of them, you would really be at a loss to see any representation of black and brown people as domestic tourists. You see it pop up, you may see a visual image, but when you look for the information,
nothing
to back up the image. So like for you, Aki? Hakim?
Rash.
You won't see anything about halal.
No.
You're going to have to go and do your own independent investigation to find out if I go there, will I be able to whatever, or else you're going to be ending up eating vegetarian the whole time.
And I can't do that.
So one thing that you mentioned earlier was about the Muslim walkers, the Muslim hikers going to the Peak District on Christmas Day. And the sense I got from the responses to that was that those who commented, who I think I'm right in saying they're exclusively white people, they felt like they owned the space. They owned the countryside. It is their space. That green space is their space. Do you think, or have you seen that the inflections of people of colour in the marketing has prompted a similar response, in the sense that, well, those who typically UK domestic tourism is directed at now feel like they're territorial, you know, this is still our space, or do they reject that marketing now? Well, because you see all the time around Christmas, if there's a Christmas ad where a black family features, I think Sainsbury's last year got massive backlash because, well, 3% of the population, you know, so is that a similar thing you're seeing in your sector too?
Similar thing happens, definitely. I mean, even with the report I was doing with Norfolk, and at some point people were saying, oh, what the, why are you saying that you should be doing anything about attracting ethnic minority to Norfolk? Norfolk is 99.9% white population there. I was like, why, if it's 99.9% population, means that people of color shouldn't go and look at the forts, shouldn't go to the beach? We shouldn't be having that kind of experience of this green and pleasant land and wonderful seasides. People do watch Escape to the Country. They do watch Country File. Everybody watches it. It's part of what comes on as BBC. You know, we pay BBC license to watch these shows.
So
what happens is that people watch that. It stirs up a desire for them to go to these places to see them too. But when you go now to put the action into that, you then have to reference, I am not of the white majority. You're not seeing that welcome. You're not seeing the information to reference what your needs are. And so you back away from it, because, you know, if you go to India or you go somewhere else, you'll have people who will, you go to Istanbul, you go to Turkey, not a problem. Not a problem, because whether you're black or whether you're Muslim or whatever other kind of, you know, there's some provision and there's a welcoming society. You're not going to be running the risk of hostile, I would just say overtly hostile, but it is hostile if you're stared at. And I got that a lot from the interviews. People were saying, why am I always stared at when I go to this? And people feel it's hostile. You know the feeling. We've all been there, where people just, you enter into a space and everybody looks up at you, and you know the staring is referencing your skin color. It's not your gender or your sex. Well, your sex. It's about your skin color.
So you mentioned there, we've all been there. And I think there's a, often an implication during research that, you know, there's objectivity, you're completely detached from you know, undertaking of that research. I'm wondering, you're a black woman, you did research around ethnic minority doing tourism in the UK. Did that have any impacts on you? What were some of the thoughts that were going through your mind when you started drawing up your findings? Did you reflect on your own experiences, on your own decision making? Can we talk to that a little bit?
Yeah, definitely, yes. There's a thing in research which is for all researchers, which is to acknowledge your positionality. And what we mean by positionality is, where are you coming from as an individual? What your experiences have led you to a particular perspective and orientation or approach to an issue. So that will determine, in many respects, a sense of what sort of knowledge or thinking, the lens through which you look at a particular problem. Now, that doesn't mean that you're any less a scholar. It's just that you take what is called a more, your epistemology, which is meaning your view of the world, says that it is not something that is objective and stands apart from how people construct reality. Okay? So it's this notion that we approach our work from our understanding, that what we are picking up or what we are learning from what people are saying is based on their own construction of their reality. So there is not like when we do the physical sciences or some of the approach to science, which says everything has to be objective. We take an approach which says we need to get into understanding how people construct their reality, their world. And so that's how I approach this. I'm saying, okay, as I said, I declare my positionality. I'm a post-colonial woman of color researcher going in with that, with these lens. So the approach I'm asking is, what's your experience like? Now, the question could be, that is one capturing of truth. Another researcher, maybe male, let's say, who have been harassed now as a category is middle-aged white men, may approach the study and perhaps may or may not come out with a similar kind of interpretation. But here is the bottom line. My approach or my findings are no less real because it is empirical. When I use the word empirical, it is grounded on actual data and questions that I ask and responses that I get. So for all the points I'm making about people's, you know, racism being a barrier, I have the evidence. I have the evidence in the courts. And if you go through the 40,000 word report, that's one of the reasons why it's so long. I was really deliberate in ensuring that I packed that report with as many instances to put the weight of evidence that there's anybody who can argue or put, in other words, that you're sure you're seeing it the way you should be seeing it. You know what I'm saying? So you can come back and look at what I have put, the interpretation that I put to it, and you can see there's justifiability. I have justified the basis on which I came to that interpretation. I hope that makes sense.
Yeah. I suppose my question off the back of that is, how did the research make you feel?
Yeah.
Because, you know, your positionality, you're still in the UK. You still work in the field. You probably look at all the communications with a completely different lens to the average Joe in the street. So how did that make you feel with all that background empirical knowledge now?
Yeah. Well, God. Well, I think I'll be honest with you. Sometimes as a researcher, you don't want to get too much into feely-feely. You know what I'm saying? Yeah. I think for me, I more want to make the argument and I'm more about building a theory. So I think that's what drives me. I'm more about coming up with a theory, like what I presented to you is a theoretical framework of how to see the different types of communities in terms of their response to travel, how they make their travel buying behavior. So I think for me, I was more driven by that. Cool. And the kind of sense of, there was a sense of aha moment, a sense of discovery, eureka, to say, okay, I'm seeing all these things. I'm hearing what people are saying, and I can put it into an explanatory framework. I can explain it. And I think for me, that's where I would say it made me feel, I'm feeling that, yes, I can make a contribution. Another kind of feeling related to that, I think, has to do as well with how I tend to position myself recently as a scholar activist. And I know the word activist has been somewhat denigrated and downplayed, like, okay, you're an activist, so you don't really study. You're not really a scholar. You know, how can you put scholar and activist? You're more somebody who is involved in argument and polemics. You don't have the evidence. There's been a lot of that going on now in the academy, in researchers say that, you know, that person is not really a scholar. They're just an activist. But if we look back to the origins of how the term scholar activist is no different, I think, than this kind of pressure academics are facing now to show where their work has impact. So it's one thing to go publish papers, but then they're now saying it in terms of the research excellence framework in universities now.
Yeah,
you did all these papers. How did it change society? Where's the impact of it? For me, that's what my scholar activism is. So from this research, I can begin to lobby groups and saying, hey, you're marketing, you're not marketing to a core population in the society. And you need to listen to them because, one, you're missing out on economic opportunities. And two, what a force for cultural cohesion and understanding. You know what I'm saying? Yep. It is one thing I think can engender a sense of belonging to a place is leisure and tourism. Plus the fact that we need to, in a sense, get our people experiencing and enjoying more of the countryside, because much of these leisure activities is associated with more healthier lifestyles.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
And a lot of the health disparities is a serious problem in diverse communities, ethnic diverse communities. It's a serious problem. We're not walking enough. We're not going outside enough. And it is lessening our quality of life. So, yeah, I'm an activist. Of course, I too felt what I feel. Oh, Kavan, sometimes, I'll be honest, disillusionment.
Mm.
Yeah, sometimes I'm disillusioned, because even with the evidence, and even when you send the reports out and you communicate it, people still don't want to know. Even sometimes the people who commission research, because it doesn't come in a way that necessarily the way to say, okay, this is how I wanted the research to be. Sometimes they're not ready for the results.
There's not an easy call to action there, is there? But by enacting on these findings, they're going to have to make some sacrifices, some changes. And whenever, as an activist, you're asking people to make those sacrifices, those changes, you meet resistance. Now, for me, seeing that statistic about 0.1% of people in the ethnic community participate in domestic tourism is stark. So there is so much room for growth, and there's so much benefit of the public impact of your work. And if I'm being facetious in some ways, I would say platforms like this certainly are useful. You know, we target a completely public audience with regards to topics that are interesting to us. And I hope people listen to this and they realize that if you are an ethnic minority, or as Marcelo and I would both say, ethnic majority, global ethnic majority. And you are thinking about visiting Durdle Door or thinking about visiting Cromer in Norfolk, go for it.
Do it.
Yeah. Because Rochelle and I, we always talk off the show, actually, about those health and well-being implications you mentioned. You know, getting out, walking more, being more active. Before this episode started, actually, me and Rochelle, we just signed up to go to hot yoga. That is something you would not associate us with going to yoga, but we want to try these things because we understand that actually...
and he mentioned as well the snowing. Snowboarding.
He wants to go snowboarding.
Yeah.
And why not? I mean, I spoke to it was a group of girls predominantly who started that company Mont Noir, which they said they were in school, they were growing up, and they noticed that nobody was like doing skiing, and they felt it was cool.
Mm.
And I think they do put a lot of fashion and design and profiling in it. But yes, that's part of the sort of image that perhaps turn off some people. In terms of our ethnic groups, it may turn off some people, say, okay, it's about the fashion. But it's not just about the fashion. They're really going out there.
Yeah.
They're going on the slopes, they're skiing, they're acquiring the skill, and they're widening the horizons of their life. And that's what one of the interviewers, the girl who ran the business, is what she was saying to me, was that she said, I just don't want to be limited to certain types of experiences. And that's why I'm saying these are outdoor leisure challenges. They want to take on the challenge of the outdoors, and they don't want any barriers or any limits to what they can do as people of color. So they want to ski, they want to snowboard, they want to go for holidays in the winter.
Yeah. I mean, two of the things that I want to pick up on based on your research was around the typology of the type of domestic tourists.
Yeah, different types, yeah.
And you mentioned about ethnic-centric tourists, and for them, this is about their behavior is influenced by the perceptions of their race. So they're going to go to, if you want, a safe space, a place where they know they're going to feel like they belong, the halal food, you know, the cultural amenities, and maybe representation in the area. And then you mentioned about the place-centric people, and they, as travelers, they're not too bothered with the cultural amenities in the sense of them fitting in. They want to see as an outsider, if you will, what that place is like. So they want to see Durdle Door. Exactly. They want to see Stonehenge for Stonehenge's sake, not for their sake, but for the sake of the artifact, which is quite interesting as a distinction.
Yes.
You then talk about subcategories, and Rochelle's going to go over these with you in terms of what they are and what they mean. So without further ado, number one.
Occasional excursionists,
just as I was saying to you, these are groups of people who we found out who would just go out periodically for a day trip, and they're mainly looking for a bargain. They're looking for something to do.
That's like me.
Wembley Market, I feel it.
So they don't really have a plan or like whatever to say, pre-planning before, say, okay, yes, I'm going to go do Oxford or do a day trip to Oxford in the summer. No, it's not like that.
It's just here and now, just disappear.
It's here and now.
Yeah.
And it's not like something they'll do every year as part of a lifestyle. But it's when they see the opportunity, they'll take it. So there are times when there's a group is going out, or they see, like if they see something advertised of a bus trip that's going to different locations, like big city trips, the people tend to like, occasional excursionists tend to like city trips.
Right.
Or a seaside trip. Rarely you see them doing countryside trips.
I think that's me. I think I fit in that category.
And then, but to be honest though, you find that, you know, who's in this category a lot as well? People who are empty nesters, people who are at pension age as well. they too tend to love to do this. So you find group of older Caribbean women going out on a bus tour.
Do you think that's just ticking off a list?
They just want to go and see Bristol and so on,
Do you think that's them just ticking things off the list then? You know, you're at an age now where I haven't seen Bristol before. Let me just jump on a bus and...
you might as well. You've got so much time. Might as well.
Yeah, mobility-wise.
That's part of it. Mm. And it's not too expensive. It's not too expensive. It's something they can do with their friends because they like the community of going out together as a group. As well. Mm. So these occasional excursionists tend to like a kind of road trip, a group trip on a bus or train. And of course, when the prices are lower. And these have a little flexibility sometimes. It's not that they only do it in when the weather is warm or in the summer months. There are occasions when they will be a little more venturesome, even in the winter, if the price is right, and if they have that group mix, you know, if they have groups of themselves as friends going out together, and they are sure about where they're going and what they're going to see. So they tend to be, quite a number of people in the older age group are falling into this category as well.
It's fascinating you say that, actually, because just thinking about my own experiences, I went to a university in Leicester, and in between Northampton and Leicester, there's Market Harborough. Now, if you got on the bus from Northampton to Leicester, there would be loads, and I mean loads, of old ladies.
Yeah, Market Harborough.
And they would get off at Market Harborough, do their little day trip in Market Harborough, whatever they're doing, I don't know, charity shops and ZZ's.
Yep.
And then they get back on the bus and go back to Northampton.
Yes, that's what they want to do. And the thing is that we have to look at the demographic of the country. Increasingly, a large number of them fall into this category. Mm. So there are economic benefits to target them. When last have you seen a kind of a picture which shows kind of older, you know, woman or whatever race going out on a trip like that? You hardly see any marketing material to reference those people and the experiences that they can have as domestic tourists.
It's a good point.
I do think I fall into that category, I think. Well, what I like, as you said, I like going to cities for day trips, food. Don't really go visit like museums or stuff or activities. Might do a few little activities, but I think I think that's me. You know, I think
And I think there's a lot of people as well. Apart from, you know, even students would do it as well. Students fall into that category too, where they just want a day trip out. You know,
break from reality.
Where places that are kind of geared up to people, I think they're kind of sometimes now trying to demarket it, are definitely Oxford and Cambridge, because it does give that kind of, lends itself to that sort of experience. You can just go there for the day, and you can do, we don't have to go to museums or whatever, you can do all sorts of different stuff. There's a wide variety of different things you can do. So such places tend to have quite an influx of people who come in for day visits. Then it becomes a problem if there are too many of them, because of course it creates problem for traffic and the local residents getting upset. And then what some of these places such as Oxford and Cambridge are wanting more of now are people who will stay overnight, because that's when the spend becomes even more. Yeah. And that's when the economic impact of visitors becomes even more higher and of more benefit.
100%. The second subcategory we got, warm weather wishes/Kavan. Yeah. This is Kavan.
100%.
Well, yeah. This is the time of travel, and it's a lot of people. They'll say, I'm not going anywhere in the winter. And it's, when I'm going somewhere, I want the weather to be warm. Nice. But as Calvin has shown, there can be some incentives to get people out of that thinking, psychographic mindset. The incentives of, as Calvin mentioned, in his own experience, family. Mm-hmm. Being there with family, it becomes a family trip, it becomes a community exercise. So you have that sort of, yes, your trade-off might be cold, but I'll be there with my bro.
Yep.
We'll be there doing activities, we're walking, you know, I'll be there with, so there is that compensation. But so what I got was couples were saying that, okay, I always, like, to be honest, one particular respondent said, I'll never travel in the winter, but sometimes I have to because my husband's birthday is in January. And sometimes we just don't want to stay home. Mm. So we end up going to a hotel together because we want to mark the occasion.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Change location.
She said, I don't really enjoy it because I would prefer if we were at home, but it's his birthday. So family can also be a way to get people to incentivize them. So there are ways to incentivize people to still travel in the winter.
I mean, looking at, we had a house in Dorchester, and that was whatever price it was. But then you look at that in May, June, July, it was literally double the price.
Was it?
And that is a factor. And what we find, even from the statistics, you see it, the fall off in terms of occupancy rates, the seasonality of the sector is a problem. And it's not really sustainable, because what we don't want is people crowding and putting a lot of pressure on infrastructure during the peak months.
Mm.
You want to have more of a spread. You want all year round kind of flow of visitors. And so, again, as you said, pricing is a factor that can address seasonality. Yeah.
Yeah.
And again, some of the appeals we can put into it, have lovely family packages. What other kinds of value added leisure experiences could be tagged on to your family going off to Dorset to even make it something that you'd want to repeat again next year?
Yeah.
You see what I'm saying?
And you mentioned in your report about the value for money aspect, and that's massive. That is absolutely, you know, you're looking at some of the prices to just go drive 3 hours down the road in the UK, pay for a hotel, pay for food, pay for all these things. You can literally get a flight to Europe for £100. You get a hotel and you're in a change of location that is more cultural.
You know, Ayman, the other day, he went to Italy for like £30.
What?
Yeah.
And what? Yeah. I think he said the flight's only like 2 hours or 3 hours, if that.
Yeah.
It's crazy.
Yeah. 2 hours.
Bro, you can't even get a train to like Manchester for £30.
Yeah.
And that's also a serious barrier as well.
Mm.
UK is expensive.
Mm.
It is.
Yeah.
The third subcategory we've got on the list is it cultural prospectors?
Prospectors, yeah. Prospectors, what we're talking about. No, I use the term prospectors because, you know, when people, you say prospectors are people who like go out there looking for gold. You know, prospectors are people who used to go out there with their little machines and, you know, when they go looking to see if they can find gold or something. Now, it's a similar kind of profile here of this kind of ethnic visitor or traveler who they want, they're into their culture. Mm-hmm. So they're into history, they're into heritage, they talk about learning, they're looking for spiritual and mental enlightenment. Yeah. And these are people who are willing to pay more because they want this kind of encounter with culture. For this group, culture is very important to them. And I think this is a very valuable group for the UK because the UK is really rich with a lot of museums and a lot of investment in different cultural experiences. But here is a challenge. For ethnic minority group, for this particular group, they too are increasingly demanding to see references of their own cultures. So point. For great houses, yeah, for great houses, where is the reference to the fact that plantations in the Caribbean or in India or whatever may have funded this particular enterprise?
They won't say that.
Know there's a lot of challenge going on now because people are saying, you're going to talk about slavery, you're going to talk about plantation in a great house, you know. But the reality is that there's a opening up of these histories.
Mm-hmm.
And cultural prospectors, they say they want to see that. They want to see more of that.
Absolutely true. This house we stayed in was built in 1792. And we were like, interesting.
18th century peak.
Yeah.
Peak time.
We thought, okay. Okay, this manor house. All right. But I must say, maybe this is my own, to my own detriment, I might say. Cultural perspectives. You know what? When I'm on holiday, I'm on holiday in every sense of the word. Mentally, you know, maybe not physically, but mentally, emotionally, I want to switch off. And I often go with people who want an itinerary, and those itineraries involve things like museums or, you know, let's walk along this really old wall. But, you know, I don't know about all that. You have to drag me along. When I'm there, I appreciate it. But in the build up, I do not want to go. Although I must reiterate, when I am there, I do appreciate it.
And that's the point. That's the point. And if you find that, forgive me, because I'm more up in the Richter scale in terms of age than you guys. But you find that your interests will change after a certain time.
Yeah, yeah, 100%.
And then you find certain things become more appealing. So you find that in the groups that I was talking to, those that were in the 50 plus range, people are still working, but, you know, past their 40s and they're now becoming, and they were very much interested in this particular area. So you find that particular demographic really are looking for stuff about places they didn't mind going to a city center, a town that highlighted, you know, those brown signs that talk about historic places.
Yeah.
They like to see that, they said, because it means that I can go there and explore. You know, and for them that's an exploration. And as I said, some of them are more fulfilling. In fact, a place that has a lot of this kind of cultural offering can influence the travel buying behavior in the point that people will be more willing to go to that location over another because they add more value in terms of the different places they can go for cultural learning and cultural interests.
Right.
Yeah.
So someone might genuinely consider Northampton because we had the third ever university in the UK way back in 1600 and whatever it was.
You told me that fact, didn't you?
That's a big piece of our history, yeah.
Yeah, but a lot of people don't know what it is.
And you know, we were the capital
thing is
as
that
well.
There isn't. It's a story, yes, but the thing is that you have to know you're going to stage that story because unless there is some clear evidence of remnants of that,
it's a short trip.
Yeah. All right, let's go.
All right.
We still have the Shoe Town, we still have Barrett's, we still have a lot of remnants of that where it's more actionable, where that's also culture. And have we really explored that in Northampton? The diversity of the Shoe Town, the shoe industry, the shoe sector?
No.
Have we really explored that? Because, I mean, I'm sure there's some, if we dig deep, we can find it.
I'm sure there's some very fascinating walks in Northampton that showcase that history.
Yeah, but what I was also saying is that showcasing just the side of the Shu Tone story that also implicates other histories, other ethnic groups. Is there association with slavery? Is there association with, well, there's association with colonization, with India and leather and all of that. There are stories that we can uncover to make it more appealing and also to attract this segment of cultural perspectives.
Yeah. Number four.
Was it outdoor leisure and tourism? I can't even say that.
Enthusiasts, yeah.
Yeah, that's the one.
Yeah, so these are people who want to go outdoors, yeah? And younger, what they want to do is to do things. They want to walk. They want to also cycle, some of them, yeah?
Oh, okay.
They want to ramble. They want to have a holiday experience, which allows them to move their bodies. It's not sedentary. It's not just, they want a little bit of, you know, outdoor experience, yeah? So it's not that they want high adventure. They want moderately active holiday experiences, and they want to see the health benefits. So again, another demographic, older demographic that's referencing that, but also some younger people.
Yeah, a lot of people.
Some younger people as
well. Hiking mountains, all of that.
Hiking mountains, yeah. You haven't said a younger people who are into their physical, you know, abilities. They want to challenge themselves that way as well. So there's also that group that are really, and they're mainly, as I said, they tend to be ethnic centric in the sense that it's about, in a sense, places where they feel safe. They want to feel safe as well.
It's a good point, actually, because you're vulnerable when you're out there and you're doing those activities and you're on your way back and you're tired. You don't want to be on edge.
No.
You want to be amongst your people, safe, so that when you are tired, you are vulnerable, you haven't got to defend yourself. It's good.
Yeah.
And the fifth category we've got on here, I think this is going to relate to everyone or a lot of us, outdoor leisure and tourism challenges.
Yeah, these are people who want something new. They want adventure. So they're not going to do, they don't just want the traditional walking, strolling and so on. So these are the ones who want to go skiing. They want to go snowboarding. They want to go deep sea fishing.
I would love to do that. It would be cool.
Really?
Yeah, you'd love to do that.
Yeah. But I can't swim. I don't think I can swim properly. I haven't swam in a while, but yeah.
That's not uncommon either.
It's not.
Have you seen? I'm following a group on Instagram that just said colored paddling. People who want to go onto the water and paddle and do sailing.
I've not, but I'm interested. So you have a group.
Yeah. I do follow them on Instagram. Since doing this research, I'm just seeing so many of these different groups, and they just cater to people who just want to go out on the river, go to the sea and do sailing, do paddling, you know, paddling in a boat. And they do have regular meetings and group trips that they plan. And for these set of group of people, it's like, don't tell me that black people don't do winter. Don't tell me black people don't go out in snow. So they definitely feel that they are beyond any sort of barrier to going out there and doing non-traditional kind of, and it's mainly linked to sporting events or kind of sports based as well. They're really into challenging that kind of separation, what says what blacks or people of color don't do. You know what I'm saying?
I love it. That's change, isn't it?
Yeah. They really challenge the notion that race is a barrier to participating in holidays. They just don't accept it.
Do you know what? I will say, thinking about my reflections, I went to Tenerife last year and we went kayaking in the sea.
Cool. Yeah.
And that was cool. Except I went with someone who had been kayaking many times before, their experience. They know how to pace themselves. I went all out for the first few minutes. Then my body's like, so I had to just keep bursting, relaxing. And then when it got to, like, we went there to see dolphins. That was the whole point, to go out there, see sea turtles, see dolphins. I didn't care about the dolphins. I didn't care about the turtles. I cared about the physical, how much can I push myself while I'm out here? And then while everyone's, oh, look, there's a dolphin. Yeah, I'm in the sea. I don't care. I'm trying to just, you know, be as active as I can. So it was really interesting to observe my own nonchalance towards the animals versus the physical activity in and of itself.
And you see, that's where you can put yourself as one of these types.
Mm.
As well, because for you, what you wanted in a sense was a challenge.
Yes.
You didn't want any spatial challenge. You didn't want any sort of physical, you wanted to overcome any sort of limits of land or sea. And it was about the embodiment, your embodied experience, participating in leisure. That was what was important for you.
Mm.
And I think, but still, that's for you as an individual. But also with the challenges, there's a notion of it that is has a bit of consideration of race. Race still factors in.
Mm.
Because the targeting, in a sense, the way how they speak or where they express themselves was like, don't tell me that as a Black person, I can't do this.
Mm.
You see what I'm saying? Mm. So for them, doing this is a way of saying, even if I'm going to be like, I think he's from Northampton, that guy Benjamin, of a Jamaican father, I think, and British mother. I think he went and represented Jamaica recent at the last Olympics in skiing.
I don't know about him.
Yeah, a Northampton-based guy.
Wow.
Yeah, Northamptonshire-based guy.
Shout out him.
Yeah, I have him in my radar to see how I can get to contact him as well for one of our activities at the university. But he is... He represents, just like you remember Cool Runnings.
Yes.
And the whole
I was thinking that, you know.
Yeah. You're going to have a Jamaican team who is like, oh, yes, we're going to do bobsledding. Yeah, we're going to enter bobsledding. Already you would have seen from the movie the kind of traditional barriers. You don't have snow in Jamaica, you know, whatever. And since then, we have seen so many other countries from who don't typically have snow, that's now participating and sending bobsled teams and performing creditably. They may not have medaled, but they surely do get some of them into at least to the finals in some of the different events. So the notions thing is that race is still an issue, because it's a notion of saying, I'm going to go above that. I'm going to shatter that stereotype.
Mm.
So there is a bit of that as well, but also, again, the physical pleasure.
Yeah.
The physical challenge is also implicated in their motivation and why they choose a particular kind of holiday experience.
So, Marcella, you've certainly got me thinking throughout this conversation. I mentioned Tenerife earlier, and I wouldn't go back, actually. And the reason I wouldn't go back is because, for me, it was like a mini England. You go there, the food offering is English fry up, burgers, chips. You might get paella. Oh, paella, I should say, sorry. Generally speaking,
paella, yeah.
it was very, they were catering for the English market. I didn't like that. I wanted to go there for other reasons, really. It just, it didn't really feel like it was a holiday other than the fact it was hot. So I didn't like that. I didn't enjoy that, which made me reflect on my own,
That means you're not what is in regular in tourism. In terms of segmentation, we have a category known as allocentrics, mid-centrics, and psychocentrics. Now, my model here that I've presented to you of types is perhaps kind of, in a sense, modeling that original one, because this set of different categories, allocentrics, mid-centrics, and psychocentrics. I'll just quickly go through it. It's the degree to which you're going to go somewhere because of the risk that you perceive of travel. Now, the last category, psychocentrics, are like what we have in mass tourism and those packages like to, what was the place, Tenerife and the Costa del Sol.
Mm.
It's appealing to people who don't want much risk, meaning they don't want nothing too different than where they come from.
Yeah,
that makes sense.
So it's a kind of mass kind of offering. So when you go there, you know you get much of the day, Hopefully, we see, still see Lineker there, or not, or Ian Wright. You want to see your Ian Wright on a Saturday and a Sunday.
Yeah, in case
you follow EastEnders, you know you can go into any other pub and get your EastEnders.
What? It's a thing
there. Okay. Bro, the World Cup was on, I think. I think the World Cup was on.
Oh, well, what? That's fair.
Was it the World Cup? What was on? Love Island was definitely on.
Was it?
Yeah, definitely on. And one of the pubs.
Tenerife is in Spain, yeah?
Yeah. Okay. There was another sort of sport event. I can't remember what it was now. I'm forgetting my sports. Mm. I'm not a sports follower. But yeah, it's interesting. You're very right. That rings a lot of bells, actually.
So it's basically the UK in Spain.
Yeah.
And for them, that's... So we have a category for them. So these are people who want not much of a difference. Mm. Psychocentrics. They don't want much of a difference from their home country. So... Mm. They want their fish and chips. They do.
And their curry sauce.
And the British version of paella with a lot of, green peas in it.
Yes, garden peas.
Which I don't think the original paella, I've never seen it in it, but then I'm not expert. But
the event, I remember now, the event was the Queen's funeral, which obviously was a global event. So actually, that wasn't very much UK-based.
Yeah, everybody was tuning in for that.
That was
what I'm saying is that you do have a category of people who don't want anything much difference, but for them, it still constitutes a... So in a sense, it's a form of extended kind of domestic tourism.
Exactly that.
Yeah. So because it's UK transposed in Europe.
And probably cheaper, to be honest.
And cheaper too. You're perfectly right. Cheaper too.
Right. Yeah. So, Marcella, what's the call to action? If you could sum it up.
The call to action, I would say, for us is to the policymakers, the planners, the marketers, the people who control the whole sort of policies around tourism. And it's a bigger agenda than tourism. It's also leisure as well. So it's to think more about inclusion with respect to the protected characteristics of race.
Okay.
We're just not all the same in everything. And because race is a protected characteristic, you have to be more intentional. You have to be more focused in terms of opening up spaces for people of color to enjoy the land of their birth. For many of them, it's a land of their birth. For some, it's, well, the country they adopted. But average young Afro-Caribbean or Asian or Chinese growing up in this country should be able to feel that they can go to the Lake District and not be stared at.
It's
going to begin, but it can begin with the people at the helm of the industry. It's good to see we're seeing more photos of people of color now doing walks and at national attractions and so on. But it's also the information. It is also the stories that you tell that suggest there is inclusion. It's also the way in which they facilitate that behavior at the different county level. So you sit on the national, let's say Visit Britain, the national body.
Yeah.
You can begin to influence what happens at the different counties by saying to them, think about when you're putting to, well, you have to start home for, what are people on your board? Who are you hiring to work?
Yeah. Mm.
In your tourist board.
It starts with you.
What's happening in the hotels? Are you hiring people of color? Are we putting them in management roles? Because all these as well can work towards ensuring that there is more inclusion, that there's more recognition, that RAF doesn't have to then go and check and do, I have to drive an hour to get some halal meat, or else I'm going to have to be vegetarian for the time that I am on holiday.
I can't do that.
So if I can challenge you a tiny, tiny bit, and the answer's implicit, but I just want you to say it. What's the benefit?
Benefit of?
Of your call to action, of enacting on your call to action.
The key benefit is economic, first of all, that's the bottom line. You have people of color who have resources. We're not all people who are on benefits.
Facts.
Okay. So there is that
We've got
economic
money.
bottom line. Okay. It's also a point about the possibility of extending the season as well. So there is that to kind of reduce seasonality. Not that people of color are going to necessarily come offbeat, but because you're marketing to them all year round, they will also respond when they see good bargains off peak and still come. So in that sense, because they know they're being marketed to, you can then extend your season as well. And thirdly, there is such a great value to gain from social cohesion, building a sense of belonging as well. National health, getting people moving, people participating, all different types of sports, people going into the countryside. Much of the countryside agencies now really suffering in terms of, well, not say suffering, but are really concerned about the lack of diversity in the countryside. And it remains an intractable problem that has not been solved as yet, fully solved as yet. So that's the call to action. We don't, and that's the benefit of the call to action. Improve lifestyle, improve health, economic benefits, inject, put in a sense of belonging, having a more cohesive society that's more resilient to fractures of people saying some sort of discourses about the fact that people don't belong, you know, provides more resilience against racism and the far right discourses. When people are included, the far right and some of these people won't have much time or much have scope for people to accept it, because we're seeing that having a group of Muslim walkers or hikers is not a problem in the Lake District. It's not something to be worried when they see an ISIS flag coming up. No.
And there we have
So
it.
those are the benefits.
And there we have it. That has been Before Our Friends Die in the Aki and Selfridge Digital Network. You've been joined by me, Kavan.
Me, Rash.
And our very special guest, Dr. Marcella Day.
Hey.
Make sure you stay tuned in, because this time, next week, we're going to get to know Marcella. We're going to ask her our signature 7 questions, where, you know, you might find out who the richest person in her phone book is. You might find out who her biggest inspiration is. And you might find out who she believes has the most potential in her life. Stay tuned and keep it locked to the Aki and Selfridge Digital Network. You've been joined by me, Kavan. I've already said that bit. But don't forget to follow us on social media at Before Our Friends Die Pod on Instagram, at Aki and Saltfish on Twitter, and without further ado, at Aki and Saltfish on TikTok too. So if social media is your bag, make sure you follow us there. If you've got any questions for us or any of our guests, please email akiandsaltfish@gmail.com and we'd love to hear from you. And finally, if you enjoyed this episode, you might love our other shows, but please share it with a friend and leave us a 5-star rating and review. We'd really appreciate it. Take care. Goodbye.
Goodbye. Marcella, what was I going to say? Your report. No, you're still on air, to be honest. I was just going to add this bit at the end. Your report, is that available for people to read or not yet?
Okay. I have distributed a report to interested persons.
Yeah.
But because of the size of it, it's over 40,000 words. I think it's a bit heavy. So what I'm hoping to get available in a couple of weeks' time is more of a shortened version without so many of, as I said, I was talking about a lot of evidence that I put in it. So to have a sort of more a shorter version, and also to produce the findings in terms of ideographics so people can visually see some of the information. So that I would want to make more readily accessible, which I'll definitely post on Twitter and on the socials. But if anybody really is interested and want to go through the full story, it's fine. Just send me an email. It's Marcella, MARCLLA.DAYE at my university. Email address, so that's at northampton.ac.uk. Send, put in a request, and I'll definitely send it to
we'll
you.
Put all your details all in the description anyway. But that'd be a very good read, to be honest.
Thank you. Take care.
Perfect.
Thank you.